From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, we'll start by fixating on the very thing we hate others to fixate on. Phony controversies manufactured by presidential campaigns to win the news cycle by distracting the media and the public. If you've seen the talking dogs in the animated movie Up, you'll be familiar with the phenomenon.
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you. My master made me this collar so that I may talk. Squirrel!
Last week, as so often happens, the media played the part of the dog. Here was CNN's Wolf Blitzer being used in an Obama campaign video, quoting Mitt Romney, sounding soft on Osama bin Laden.
It's not worth moving heaven and earth, spending billions of dollars just trying to catch one person. He was referring to the hunt for Osama bin Laden.
Now, of course, Romney's 2007 criticism of President Obama's hunt for bin Laden was far more nuanced than this video, or Blitzer's original report, would suggest. But as John Cassidy of The New Yorker wrote recently, neither Mitt Romney's actual position nor his relative decisiveness as a leader were really the point of this brouhaha. In this case, the point was to draw the attention of the easily distracted dog away from the recent less-than-stellar economic indicators. And blatant mischaracterization was merely the method.
This is all a very cynical game. In this instance, surely they had this ad on tap for a while, but they chose to release it on a Friday when there was pretty bad economic news. The GDP had slowed down in the first quarter. Bad news for Obama. If you're in Chicago at the Obama HQ, what you want is something to divert attention from that story. This video that they put out, it wasn't actually an ad, it was just a video they put on YouTube. That's how these things work. Within a day or two, everybody who covers the campaign had more or less forgotten about the economic news, and they were talking about the bin Laden raid and whether Romney would have done it or not.
The Romney campaign also saw the video as an opportunity to accuse the president of politicizing the bin Laden mission.
If I was in the Romney camp, I would have said that too, but I really don't think that has much impact. I mean, we all know that both sides are going to exploit whatever they can for their advantage. I mean, for Republicans to, you know, accuse Democrats of showboating on national security is pretty crazy.
Mission accomplished.
Exactly. I think Romney would have been much better served to acknowledge it in some way, but spend the day at a factory or a job center or some way trying to change the subject.
But he didn't go to the factory.
I want to take you to Manhattan, where Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani are marking the one-year anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden. They're at a fire station where 11 firefighters from the station died on September 11th.
And then the president one-upped him again.
Good evening from Bagram Air Base. This outpost is more than 7,000 miles from home. But for over a decade, it's been close to our hearts.
Now, there's Romney down with Giuliani thinking it's going to reflect well for him and what happens, but Obama pops up on TV from Afghanistan, where he's flown through the night secretly. And it was all an attempt to turn what would have been a one-day story into a week-long story, and that seems to have worked out pretty well from the White House's perspective, as far as I can see.
But I want to get back to what I alluded to in the introduction, which was that his victories were aided and abetted by a press writing about stuff that really is just a bunch of campaign optics. And yet, there's no candidate who can't depend on the press to, in your words, take the bait. What should we be doing when campaigns try to manipulate us?
I think that's a very deep question. Obviously, in an ideal world, the media should ignore it or point out the inaccuracies in it and then move on to other subjects. But it's just such an enormous industry covering the campaign these days that's never going to happen. So I'm all for hand-wringing on the part of the media and saying, you know, let's not be manipulated by the campaigns. But I think it's going to be very hard to actually put that into practice. Somebody's going to write about it, and then everybody else has to follow to catch up.
In this case, you did a post-mortem of it in The New Yorker, and now I'm doing a post-mortem of your post-mortem. Are we all just sucked into the same vortex of stupidity?
I don't know about stupidity, but certainly, you know, sort of campaign trivia. I mean, I tend to look at this period of the campaign as sort of a phony war between the two campaigns. It's another 4 months until the conventions. neither side has really put out any serious policy documents yet about what they're going to do if they win. So we as journalists are left in this great vacuum where we have to try and fill it with day-to-day stories. And the campaign know that, so they produce a series of, as I say, bait stories, which we end up swallowing one way or the other, even if only in the sense of using it as an opportunity to sort of lacerate ourselves.
What follows is my editorial comment. John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Cassidy is a staff writer for The New Yorker.
John Cassidy says we're entering 4 months of mindless election-related chatter, much of which will be driven by political ads. But some hoped that last week's FCC ruling requiring TV stations to post information about who paid for those ads and how much they paid could yield some actual insights into the campaigns. A TV station's public file contains a great deal of salient information about the purchase of political ads, useful for citizens and journalists trying to track how much money campaigns are spending in their area. But until that FCC ruling last week, the requirement to make public files available didn't extend to posting them online, which meant the public had to physically go to the TV station if they wanted to see the file. But don't get too excited yet, says ProPublica reporter Justin Elliott, because the FCC requirement comes with a host of caveats. Justin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Because of Citizens United, there are all of these super PACs that can outspend the campaigns, except they don't have to comply with the same kind of disclosure requirements that the campaigns do. This effort to get the broadcasters to disclose, is that a way of coping with Citizens United?
This effort to get these files online predated Citizens United. That said, I think it's fairly clear that the chairman of the commission made a push to get these files online in part as a response to Citizens United and the expected tidal wave of money that's going to be spent in the campaign. If a super PAC, say, swoops into some congressional district 2 days before the election and starts buying advertising, you'll be able to tell exactly what elections they're trying to influence. There's a lot of focus in the media and a lot of coverage about the large amounts of money that are coming into campaigns. This is really the other side of the equation, where that money is going, whether the stations are fulfilling their obligations to give candidates the lowest ad rates and also to give equal opportunity to competing candidates.
Have stations been caught not following these obligations in the past?
They have in the past, yeah.
When we spoke last January to a representative of the National Association of Broadcasters, he said the big problem was that it would impose a burden on local broadcasters, that it cost a lot of money to put that stuff online. As the FCC decision deadline approached, you've reported that the broadcasters changed tactics, used a different argument.
Their new argument was by publishing these political ad data, they were publishing what are in effect their lowest rates because the law is that they have to extend the lowest rates to political candidates, and that would hurt their negotiations with other commercial advertisers. So say the local car dealership would see that they were charging the Obama campaign $100 for a spot and they would demand a lower rate as well. Pro-disclosure advocates countered that this data is already public.
So all that lobbying, all that argument couldn't defeat the passage of this disclosure rule. But the final version isn't all transparency advocates hoped it would be.
It has serious limitations. They opted for a phased-in system under which the only stations that have to come into compliance are the four major affiliates in the top 50 markets, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox. That's expected to cover about 60% of political ad spending this election.
Meaning that crucial swing states wouldn't have to post this information at all.
Some markets in those states, there was an analysis by the Sunlight Foundation looking at where the top 50 broadcast markets are compared to the swing states. And they found that in some markets in Virginia, some markets in Pennsylvania that are expected to see a lot of political advertising, they don't fall into the top 50. Those political ad files are still going to be stuck in paper files at the stations until 2014, when all stations around the country have to come into compliance.
So what else is wrong with it besides the fact that it may not cover key areas of the country during the election?
The other crucial issue for people who are looking to use this data and analyze it is what format will it be posted in online. The FCC had a working group that was sort of laying the groundwork for this rule, and the working group recommended that this data be put online in a single format that was searchable. The FCC decided not to require the stations to submit the data in a single format. And I've looked at a lot of these files. Some of them are hardly readable. It looks like they've gone through a fax machine three times before being scanned. That's going to be a major barrier to actually analyzing the data on any kind of scale.
So it isn't going to be easy, but at least you don't have to travel to the individual stations and ask for access to their boxes of files. But that is precisely what your group, ProPublica, has asked college students to do in that 40% of the marketplace that isn't covered by the rule yet.
Right. We're asking not just college students, but anyone, readers, other journalists, to go to their local stations, ask for the political file, email it to us, and we're posting it on ProPublica so everyone can see it.
ProPublica's project is called Free the Files, and we'll link to that on our website.
Thank you.
Justin Elliott is a reporter for ProPublica. When we first reported this story, we spoke with Jack Goodman, the former general counsel for the National Association of Broadcasters, who told us that putting the files online would be too costly and burdensome for broadcasters. We spoke to him again this week for comment, and he noted that in pointing out the potential harm of making their lowest rates widely known, broadcasters were not abandoning their argument about the cost of posting those files online.
Coming up, new ways to track you online and new ways to cover your tracks.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, working for national energy policies to create jobs and spur investment at PewTrust.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In this part of our show, the tug of war between cyber safety and privacy. We'll start on Capitol Hill. Last Thursday, the House passed the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, also known as CISPA. The bill aims to help government investigate cyber threats, both to national security and to private enterprise. How it works is CISPA encourages government agencies and tech companies to exchange information about users' online activities by shielding those tech companies from legal liability. Now, civil liberties advocates contend that the bill fails to define what exactly constitutes a cyber threat, and that it places too few limits on how the government can use the information it gleans. Noting these concerns, the president has threatened to veto the bill. Representative Adam Schiff, a California Democrat, was for the bill before he was against it. He supported its introduction to protect against the theft or misuse of information, but voted against it when he was unable to ensure that certain privacy protections were put in place.
I offered an amendment that would have required the amount of personal information that is caught up in the cybersecurity information sharing is minimized, that the least degree possible we include personal identifiable information. That amendment was not agreed to. It was not even allowed to get a vote on the floor.
And you also asked for some other changes.
Yes, I think that the Department of Homeland Security really needs to be the lead and point agency. We're talking about the sharing of domestic information. And while the NSA would be much more efficient, you know, the NSA to some degree is in the electronic surveillance business. And we need them to be, and they're very good at it. But they are not the agency most Americans think of when they think of privacy. I would add one other thing on this, Brooke, and that is one of the concerns that has been raised about the current legislation is that private companies can be having independent relationships with members of the intelligence community, giving and taking information. And unless there is a central clearinghouse for that, which I think should be DHS, then it becomes much more difficult for Congress to oversee the process.
What about the complaint that the bill fails to define what constitutes a cyber threat? Did you address that in any of your proposed changes, and did any of them play out in the bill?
Yes, I did, and no, they didn't. I did address it in amendments that I offered, narrowing the information that would be determined to be cyber information. Again, they were not allowed to have a vote on the House floor. Similarly, I offered an amendment that would basically spell out what the government can do with this information that it receives. We want it obviously to be used for cyber defense, but we don't want it as a fishing expedition, and we don't want the government using it as a stalking horse to do other things.
What kind of abuse is the president and are you concerned about?
You could have a situation where two companies conspire with each other to raise prices in an antitrust fashion or share information in a way that doesn't protect the identities of their customers and their customers' identities are stolen, and then have the companies make the defense that, no, they have immunity under the cyber statute.
Joseph Lieberman, Susan Collins, Dianne Feinstein, and Jay Rockefeller have introduced an alternate bill in the Senate. Does this bill offer the protections that you wanted the House bill to offer?
It won't go as far as I would like it to go. That's the unfortunate nature of compromise in our system. But hopefully it will be a good enough work product where we can balance both goals of protecting the country from this ongoing cyber threat and damage that we're sustaining, and at the same time maintain our privacy interests so the American people are confident that their personal information isn't going to be misused or sacrificed without any benefit to the national security.
Congressman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adam Schiff is a congressman for California's 29th District.
If CISPA does pass, your service provider might well end up providing your information to the government. Nick Merrill has a possible solution. He was the first person ever to successfully challenge a national security letter. That's a secret government demand for information, and if you get one, you're not allowed to tell anyone. Merrill fought that gag order and won. Now his organization, Calix, is building a different kind of internet service provider. He's enlisted privacy hawks and ex-National Security Agency executives as advisors and designed a system to make it nearly impossible for the government to extract customer information from him, even if he's compelled to.
The concept here is to use encryption, which scrambles the data, and then to leave the only set of keys that can unlock the data in the hands of the user. I mean, I would like to point out that the system that we're building doesn't preclude the government from getting people's data if they really need it. But probably the best procedure for them to do that in this kind of a situation would be to go directly to that user and get their private key in order to unlock the data.
Won't the encryption make it impossible for law enforcement to conduct an investigation without informing the subject that he's under scrutiny?
No. I can even give you a real-world example where it was done. Nicky Scarfo. He was an alleged mafia don, and he used encryption technology on his email. The authorities apparently got the right to tap his internet, but they weren't able to read his emails. They broke into his house when he was away, and they put a device called a keylogger on his computer, which fits typically between the computer and the keyboard. The police thus obtained his password and then were able to unlock his emails, and he was none the wiser until one day they kicked down his door and had all the evidence they needed to convict him. So I see no reason why it couldn't be done again.
Why don't existing ISPs encrypt their data? Is it only because they make money mining the data for behavioral and contextual information about the user?
There's probably quite a number of reasons why. First of all, the status quo is that everything is open. So you would have to have some kind of a reason to change that. I just happened to come up with this idea that this needs to be re-examined, in part due to, you know, my experiences with the National Security Letters provision of the Patriot Act. But it wasn't just about that. It also touches on some greater issues that the country has in terms of cybersecurity. I'm making an argument with this new service that I'm trying to set up that cybersecurity and privacy in a lot of ways are the same issue but with different framing. And to the extent that we can get a lot of people to use strong encryption on their data and on their communications, we can do something to address both of those issues at the same time.
It seems to me that there is at least one federal law requiring ISPs and other telecom providers to have a back door accessible to government who, with a search warrant or a subpoena, can get access to the very kinds of content we're describing. If an encrypted ISP essentially welds that back door shut, would Calix be in violation of federal law from day one?
I'm assuming that you're speaking of the CALEA law passed in 1994. It originally just applied to telephones, and when the telephone service went from analog to digital, the authorities decided they needed a backdoor built in so that they could easily capture the communications. And over time, it was expanded to cover also broadband internet and voice over IP. So we're going to have a backdoor so that communications can be captured. The catch, though, is that whatever communications that we'll be able to hand over will be encrypted. To the best of my knowledge, I think we found our niche where we comply with everything, but we stick to the principle that the user owns their data.
Nick, thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Nick Merrill is the founder of Calix Internet Access and the Calix Institute. Last month, President Obama announced new sanctions targeting individuals and entities that sell surveillance software and hardware to Iran and Syria. But the use of this surveillance technology is much broader than just those two countries. It's employed to monitor citizens across the region, including nations considered allies by the United States. Margaret Coker, Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, has been part of the award-winning team behind Censorship Inc., a series dedicated to tracking the use of this technology in the region. She was in Libya during the rebel siege on Tripoli, and after days of searching, found herself standing in one of Muammar Gaddafi's surveillance centers.
My taxi driver, who had been tortured by Gaddafi, took me back to the place where he had been imprisoned, and that was the secret headquarters for the surveillance technology as well. So he was breaking out into a cold sweat. I walked into this abandoned building that was littered with AK-47 cartridges. There were refrigerator-sized computer servers that had gone offline. There wasn't any electricity in the city at that point. And probably half a football field-sized room full of the printouts of people's email chats, Facebook chats, and a whole lot of other online correspondence kept by the regime.
The hardware that made this possible for the Gaddafi regime was manufactured and imported by Western companies.
That's right. There was a French software company that's now a subsidiary of a larger defense contractor with very close ties to the Sarkozy government. The French company actually developed it and kept refining it according to the Libyan needs. And what the Libyans wanted to do was monitor people that Gaddafi considered enemies of his regime. And as far as all of the hard copy files that I was able to sift through, these people weren't Islamic extremists. They weren't jihadis. These were human rights workers. They were democracy activists. Basically, it seemed like if you had written an email that just criticized Gaddafi or a member of his family, that started your file going then.
So as you go around the world from repressive regime to repressive regime, how much of this infrastructure is built locally? How much of it comes from China? And how much of it does come from the West?
Well, there's great competition between Chinese-manufactured surveillance technology and Western countries' own technology. Technology is, it's like a knife. It can slice butter for your bread in the morning, and it can also be used to commit murder. There is no moral compass for this surveillance technology.
The president's sanctions aim at Iran and Syria, but our nominal allies are using similar technology to monitor their own populations. Is anything being done to limit the sale of surveillance architecture in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and so on?
No. If you're an enemy and there's a lot of bloodshed in your country, like Syria, you get sanctioned in executive orders. If you're an ally who says that they want to keep a nuclear weapon out of Iranian hands, like Saudi Arabia does, you can buy this technology to monitor your own pro-democracy activists. There is no outcry in Washington about the Saudi dissidents that have been put in jail, or much outcry, unfortunately, about the Bahraini activists also put in jail. The executive order is I'd consider it a political feel-good press release. The White House can look good about its record on human rights and standing up for democracy, as well as keep clear of the very thorny issue of trying to define surveillance technology, redefining what should be banned exports or not banned exports. In an election year, you really don't want to make an enemy out of tech companies or their lobby in Northern California.
So if what the president is doing is strictly election year atmospherics, can and should the West be cracking down on any kind of export of this technology?
One thing that our series shows is that governments and companies in not-so-savory countries will be able to get around bans and sanctions. They'll procure things because there's always a middleman who will sell it on to them. I mean, right now, you have surveillance networks that exist in almost every single Middle Eastern country. What should be done is probably help those activists in those countries find ways around the surveillance net that has been set up.
Margaret, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Margaret Coker is Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Activists and others, help is on the way, potentially, from a group called Commotion Wireless. It's designing software that lets impromptu networks spring up quickly and quite anonymously. Sasha Meinrath is the director of the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative and the founder of Commotion Wireless. He says that the best way to ensure that users of his software are protected from prying eyes is to let those prying eyes know every single thing they might want to know.
Every time there's a news story on this, we get a number of inquiries. We've probably had several thousand from almost every country on Earth. And of course, we don't know who many of these people are. They could be from exactly the countries where these kinds of technologies would be most useful. Because of our approach to make all the information as open and available as possible, we don't worry about having to do the due diligence before providing information to them because everything is already publicly available.
Tell me how giving the bad guys access to what you're doing doesn't enable them to reverse engineer your software and neutralize Commotion.
Sure. Well, you can imagine if I asked you to randomly pick a number between 1 and 100 million, and I told you that based on whatever random number you choose, I'm going to use that to encode my message, that just because you know how I generated that random number doesn't necessarily mean you can guess that random number. And encryption works very much the same way. It's far easier to encrypt and secure a communication than to decrypt.
Let's talk a bit about the architecture of Commotion to begin with. It is creating ad hoc networks of wireless devices in a way that prevents regimes or any other eavesdroppers from being able to shut somebody down at a central source. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that works.
Sure, most people will be familiar with a cell phone network. And every cell phone on that network connects from that cell phone up to a central tower. Now, if I'm trying to surveil or censor, the place where I put all of that technology is on that central tower. If you have an ad hoc network, say a cell phone talks directly to another cell phone, it never goes through that central tower. It just requires then an inordinate amount of energy to be in every single location between every single kind of communications that might happen. And if you add on top of that then layers of encryption between these devices, it becomes far more difficult to shut down or to surveil.
It's easy to see that if you can build these ad hoc networks, you know, you'd be able to, for example, to go about your dissident behavior without fear of being arrested and tortured and so forth. It also would seem that if you were an organized criminal doing human trafficking, drugs, you name it, this would also be a very handy technology to have.
Absolutely. Every powerful communications tool is a Faustian bargain. What this is really just making explicit a reality that's already here. Amongst geeks and hackers and what have you, they're already using these kinds of technologies. Most of what we're doing is putting these really useful technologies in the hands of the larger populace.
Including terrorists and criminals.
Well, I feel that we have laws and rules and human intelligence that helps address that.
The U.S. Department of State is substantially bankrolling this project with $2 million. That's kind of an odd bedfellow, considering that I assume the New America Foundation has some not insignificant issues with the way the U.S. government conducts surveillance.
Correct. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important that all the code remain completely open, that it becomes very clear that there's no secret back doors or other malfeasance that might have snuck in. I would say when it comes to things like surveillance and foreign policies, there is a complexity there. On the one hand, for example, we want to empower copyright holders to enforce copyright and prevent piracy. And so the U.S. government puts forward more surveillance and monitoring of internet traffic. And on the other hand, we want to ensure that there is security and privacy of communications for human rights workers and democracy advocates. And so we want to build the perfect circumvention technologies to prevent monitoring and surveillance. And it is right now very much a reality that both agendas, which are at times mutually exclusive, are both being forwarded.
All right, Sasha. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Sasha Meinrath is the founder of Commotion Wireless, which is being developed at the New America Foundation, a think tank in Washington, D.C.
Coming up, a local Palestinian TV station is raided by the Israelis, and it seems everyone and no one is at fault.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Palestinian Authority is clamping down on its critics. Recently, it's blocked several opposition websites. Its security forces have arrested journalists and an activist. And on Thursday, the communications minister resigned in response to the authority's curbing of press freedom. Meanwhile, Al Watan, an independent TV station based in the West Bank, is being sued for $1 million over its corruption investigation involving the son of a Palestinian official, according to The Guardian. And this follows raids in February by Israeli Defense Forces on both Al Watan TV and Al Quds Educational TV, which supplies such programs as Sesame Street to the community. Journalist Duad Khattab helped set up Al-Quds TV back in 1996, the same year as Watan. He says that back then, the Palestinian media landscape was barren.
Before 1993, there was no Palestinian television of any sort. As part of the Israeli-Palestinian Oslo Agreement, two things happened. The Israelis reluctantly agreed to allow Palestinian Authority to establish a national television and radio station. But also local entrepreneurs created low-power TV and radio stations that broadcast terrestrially in the cities. In addition, the agreement includes a clause that sets up a joint Israeli-Palestinian technical committee. And this committee is supposed to look at requests for frequency allocations, but it had to be an agreement by both parties.
How did that work out?
Well, it didn't work out because the Israelis never allowed this committee to meet. And because you need both sides to meet, basically the Israelis had a veto power of anybody getting any licenses. So when the committee never met, individuals literally took the frequencies. I mean, people set up station, bought in the black market a transmitter, and just went on air. Eventually, the Palestinian Authority basically recognized these frequencies. But it was basically an attempt to regulate something that was already taken by individuals doing it on their own.
So how did the Israelis approach these stations?
The Israelis basically turned a blind eye to this, except a few cases in which some of the frequencies interfered with airport frequencies or military frequencies. And then they would usually issue a very tough warning to the Palestinian Authority. And usually the Palestinian Authority would inform that particular station to shift the frequency one way or another to avoid the areas where the Israelis were upset about.
You actually helped establish Al-Quds, which is one of the two TV stations that were raided by the Israelis in February. What kind of a role did Al-Quds and Al-Watan play in the region What's their significance now in an age where there's a lot of satellite and television channels?
You know, it's like in the States you have something called the public access station.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so popular, but, you know, there are some people who do watch it and some people who don't have satellite stations watch it. There are issues that are dealt with locally that are not covered in any national station, but it's not a major influencer of the public. As a terrestrial local station, Watan is an important factor.
So the Israelis raided Al-Watan and Al-Quds in February. You said the reasons aren't really important. What's important is that these frequencies just aren't being regulated properly.
That's true. I mean, the Israelis have basically two choices. They can have the Joint Committee meet and have these frequencies regulated, or if they have a particular problem with a particular frequency, as in these two cases, they could have done it the civilized way. You don't just barge in the middle of the night and take the transmitters. In the overall Middle East conflict, is it the major issue? I know, I wouldn't argue that, but it does reflect the power structure in which occupying powers just barge in using its military power to exercise subjugation of a population that's under occupation.
Dawood, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dawood Khattab is a journalist, TV producer, former Princeton professor, and general director of Community Media Network. Muammar Arabi is the general director of the station Al-Watan. He was in the States to talk to donors and rights groups. This was before we learned that his station was being sued for $1 million for their investigation into corruption at a university and the involvement of the son of a Palestinian official. He described to me the philosophy of Al-Watan.
Watan TV was the first independent TV station operated in Palestinian territories. Watan in Arabic meaning homeland. It's not affiliates for any political party. There is the governmental TV and the other TV stations. It's the mouth of Hamas from Gaza. So the Palestinian people, they need Watan TV as a free platform. And Watan TV, the most watched local TV station in Palestinian territories.
If I were to turn on Watan television, what would I have seen?
We focus mainly in the local news, the local taste. Unfortunately, in the mainstream media, they just focus about the political issue, which is important from my point of view. But I think there is another life in Palestine. There is a story. The Palestinian people achieved a lot of success stories. There is a lot of cultural events, cultural life, social life.
Your station was known for investigative journalism. What kinds of investigations?
Mainly, we focus about the taboo issues that the governmental media and official media avoid, like corruption in the Palestinian Authority, social issues such as the honor killing for the women's.
Honor killings.
Honor killings about the discrimination, about the healthcare system.
Describe then how Al-Watan fits into the Palestinian media landscape.
In Palestine and in Arab world, we are suffering many, many years from the governmental media. They focus about the false positive issues. It's a propaganda for the governments everywhere. There is another type of media. It's a private media, totally run by business people. Sometimes it's much worse because even the business people, they have agenda they want to promote. But Watan, it's a unique model in Palestine. It's not owned by anybody.
How is it supported?
There is no personal shareholders. Watan covered its operational cost from different sources, advertisement and commercial revenue. 50% of our overhead came from donations, American, European. In 2007, two big American organizations, State Department and USAID, invested a lot in Watan. And most of the important equipment that confiscated is donated to Watan by American people. This is not my own equipment only. This is the money, this is the equipment and the money of American taxpayer.
What happened on February 29th? You were there.
In February 29th, the Israeli army came to Watan at the middle of the night. They confiscated all of my equipments. We haven't any computer to write our news. All of our financial records confiscated. They confiscated our archive, our footage. According to Oslo Agreement, Ramallah under total control of Palestinian Authority, which means even when they came to Ramallah and enter Ramallah, this is illegal.
Now, the Israelis say that it had repeatedly warned your station that you were using frequencies that violated Israeli-Palestinian agreements and that interfered with transmissions in Israel.
Oh, the Israeli, they discovered our frequency illegal after 17 years? We are broadcasted since 1996. And according to Oslo Agreement, we need the approval of the Israeli and the Palestinian. There is a technical committee to approve the signals. And when we got the approval of Palestinian Authority, that means we got the approval of Israeli.
Harassing Palestinian journalists is not an exclusively Israeli occupation. Human Rights Watch called on the Palestinian Authority and Hamas to stop harassing Palestinian journalists as well. Has your station had any problems with Palestinian authorities?
Of course, it's not secret. Watan TV closed 5 times by Palestinian Authority. We are suffering from daily pressure from Palestinian Authority. We are suffering from Hamas government in Gaza. In Gaza now, it's impossible to cover or to produce any stories. Sometimes our journalists in Gaza, they send our footage through FTB, and we couldn't mention their names because we are afraid to arrest them in Gaza.
What's your background?
I studied medical science and crisis management. And when Watan destroyed in 2002, the board director approached me to find solution how we can manage with the crisis that Watan facing that time, totally destroyed, totally collapsed. That time, I went to the TV just for 3 months. And then I take my decision to stay. And we started from nothing, from zero. That time, we haven't any camera in the TV. I have a small camera and a small computer. I bring it. We use this camera for a news gathering. I stay months in my office, working in the morning and sleeping in the couch to find solution how we can save Watan. Because there is a lot of independent Palestinian. They love their life. They love Palestine. So we think that our voice not heard for our community and over the world. Most of us, we are working 16 and 17 hours daily because we believe about Watan voice. It's our dream. And it's very painful to see that they want to kill our dreams.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moammar Arabi is General Director of Al Watan TV. Aidan Bartal is Director General of the Israeli Ministry of Communications. He flatly denies Duad Katab's allegation that the Israeli-Palestinian Joint Technical Committee had never met. He says he's personally met with the committee many times, and he says Watan TV was operating illegally.
We have, since 1995, an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians that allowed the Palestinian side to have 6 television stations, but they have now 25. And we are suffering a lot of interference to our spectrum, and this is in breaching of the agreement. Israel, that has 3 or 4 times the population, has only 3 TV stations, and the Palestinian agreed to have double the number. Now, they chose which are the 6.
The Palestinians themselves designated which 6 stations they were allowed to keep, and they didn't pick Al Watan.
Al Watan was not part of the 6 stations within the agreement.
And you're also saying that Al Watan created broadcast interference, even though it's existed for more than a decade without anyone having alleged that interference in the past.
Interference can be created by the equipment becoming obsolete or part of the equipment is in defect. So things like that happened all the time. We're speaking about severe interference to our customers, to our usage, which is in breach of a bilateral agreement.
According to reports, the raid was undertaken in the middle of the night using military personnel who confiscated transmitters, financial records, and even archives. Why was the operation undertaken in this manner?
First of all, you know what was confiscated? I'll tell you, 1 modem.
And all this to remove a modem?
Yes, before this interview, I called the people on the ground just to make sure that I will not mislead you. I was informed very clearly that the only thing that was taken from both stations were the modems.
A representative of the IDF told us, and I quote, "In accordance with the law, several transmitters were confiscated during the course of the activity."
Only the modem, not the transmitters and not other pieces of equipment.
Modems do not interfere with radio frequencies.
We didn't want to take the whole station and the whole equipment. We preferred not to take this dramatic measure. What we want to make sure is that they understand that we are suffering from severe interference, and we ask the Palestinian Authority many times to take measures that it will not continue. And only as a last resort, we had to go in.
I'm just puzzled by the removal, you say, of a modem, which is contrary to the statement we received from the IDF, and contrary to common sense, because if interference is the problem, the removal of a modem would have no impact.
No, it's for them to understand that this is a fundamental breach of the agreement between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. It's not a joke. We were eligible to take all the station out. I'm just saying, for the sake of good order, that we took just one piece. But if next time we'll take more than that, I'm not coming to apologize. We are not the one creating interference to someone else, which is legal. So I'm not coming to apologize about something that every reasonable society would take against illegal activities.
Why undertake it with Israeli defense forces in the middle of the night?
First of all, the only way to do it in the territories is through the forces. Be realistic. The way to do it is conducted that nobody will be hurt. This activity, which is dangerous to Israelis, was conducted in a way that nobody will harm them or any civilian. So this is the only motivation on this case about choosing the way and choosing the time and choosing the place.
And all this to remove a modem. It is puzzling, don't you think?
I take your note about it, and we might consider next time to take more equipment of illegal TV stations or radio stations.
I hear your sarcasm. It just seems to me you're using an elephant gun to remove a mosquito.
To focus only on the pieces taken and not on the illegal, it sounds to me very partial. I'm feeling that we are treated a little bit unfairly. Here we took the minimum measures possible, the minimum, in a very cautious way. And we are criticized for what? For taking the last measure as a last resort after exhausting all other possible ways. Now we are not speaking just about having dozens of or more than 100 radio illegal stations and 19 TV stations. We are speaking about a severe interference to our spectrum. We are not the party that breached the agreement or creating for them problems that are not reasonable.
I hear you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aidan Bartal is the Director General of the Israeli Ministry of Communications. Thank you very much again. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and I'm sorry for that, but I just met one of the owner of the local radio station in Israel. He said, I can't use that. We're paying money to the government to get frequencies, and our audience can't hear us. And I'm talking about 130 to 150 at any given time illegal radio stations. You know, we had it also in Israel, a piracy in radio stations, but we cracked down on all of them. Many of them were by religious groups, so we finished with that. And now the situation is much worse. I mean, after we finished with all the Israelis, we don't know what to do.
The Israeli-Palestinian conflict plays out in opposing universes with different names for the same monuments, different narratives for the same events, different readings of the same laws, and certainly different perspectives of what is fair and just. The IDF functions as Israel in the territories and resolved in this case what Israel viewed as a persistent treaty violation and bureaucratic headache. The Palestinians viewed it as the crude military reflex of an arrogant occupier. While the tale of Al-Watan is a mere blip in the overall conflict, every little incident tells the whole story of irreconcilable difference and the fragility of independent voices, which offer perhaps the only chance of resolution.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Robert Schoon, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.